Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 9th of October, these are our main stories. The Trump administration is now refusing to cooperate with the impeachment inquiry. Where does this leave the investigation? A Brexit deal is now essentially impossible. That's according to a UK government source, but the EU doesn't agree. So what's going on? And what can be done for the billion people suffering from treatable eye problems? Also in this podcast, find out why Britain's nuclear missile plan in the 1960s relied on having enough change for a payphone. First, American politics is getting ever closer to a showdown after the White House announced it will not cooperate with an impeachment inquiry against President Trump. A White House lawyer has written to leading Democrats in the House of Representatives saying President Trump could not participate in an inquiry which they say violates fairness and due process. Earlier, Mr. Trump attacked the inquiry, calling it a kangaroo court, and the State Department blocked the US ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, from appearing before the impeachment investigation. The Democrat leading the inquiry, Adam Schiff, said the White House was also withholding text messages Mr. Sondland had exchanged with Ukrainians, fellow diplomats, and at least one U.S. senator.
It is hard to overstate the significance of not just Ambassador Sondland's testimony and the documents, but the testimony of others as well. The failure to produce this witness, the failure to produce these documents, we consider yet additional strong evidence of obstruction of the constitutional functions of Congress.
Gordon Sondland was also facing questions about any role he played in prodding Ukraine to investigate President Donald Trump's political rival, Joe Biden. Our correspondent in Washington, Anthony Zerka, has this assessment of the latest developments.
The State Department and the White House are really digging in their heels across the board on this. Donald Trump himself says this is a kangaroo court, that the Democrats are investigating, that it's a sham, and he doesn't want to take part in it at all. Democrats, meanwhile, are pointing to this as evidence that the White House is obstructing the investigation, and they could say that they have something to hide in this whole matter, and they could use this against them when considering impeachment. I mean, the bottom line is that both sides seem to be digging in and that there doesn't seem to be any cooperation. And with polls showing the American support for impeachment increasingly going up, it appears that the executive branch and the legislative branch, that is Congress, are on a collision course.
Anthony Zerka. To Brexit now, and back in 2017, the then Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson told the UK Parliament this.
There is no plan for no deal because we are going to get a great deal.
Fast forward 2 years, he's now Prime Minister, and a source in his office is now proclaiming that a Brexit deal is essentially impossible after Mr. Johnson had a phone call with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, in which she apparently dismissed the latest British plans. But the EU's top official, Donald Tusk, has hit out at Boris Johnson, accusing him of trying to win a stupid blame game, saying the future of Europe was at stake. The UK, of course, is due to leave the EU at the end of this month. Michael Gove is the British minister in charge of preparing for a no-deal Brexit.
We've put forward a fair and reasonable compromise for all sides that respects the historic referendum result, and we hope that the EU will engage with us seriously. And in setting out these proposals, we've moved. It is now time for the EU to move too. However, if the EU does not move, this government is prepared to leave without a deal on the 31st.
Well, our UK political correspondent is Rob Watson.
I don't think you need to be the most astute political reporter ever born to kind of detect what's coming out of Downing Street. And it's a pretty brutal message. It's saying, really, we don't think there's going to be a deal. That's going to be the EU's fault. And we're going to play really tough. If we have to stay inside the EU, if there's any extension to the Brexit process, we're going to remember who did that and be as disruptive as possible. Then we're going to fight a populist election here in the UK. Basically, the people, those who voted leave against everybody else.
And there's a real escalation in language, both sides keen to blame each other for this.
Absolutely. But I think the escalation, I think it's fair to say, I mean, one's to be careful, but it started very much on this side of Europe. There's no doubt this started in the UK, not in Brussels. Brussels has responded. But look, of course, both sides are very anxious to avoid getting the blame for the likely economic disruption from a no-deal Brexit. But it seems to me it's really the UK side which has doubled down. And I think to understand that, you have to understand where Boris Johnson and his team are coming from. These were the people behind the Vote Leave campaign. And it seems to me that they have decided their very political survival depends on delivering Brexit either on the 31st of October or to be seen to have thrown everything at it in trying to do that. No matter what the sort of costs are at home and indeed abroad.
That was Rob Watson. The new director of the International Monetary Fund has given a bleak forecast for the world economy. Without directly naming the US-China trade row, Kristalina Georgieva said trade disputes had caused a synchronized slowdown, expected to affect 90% of global economic activity. She said the fallout could last a generation. She's been speaking to our correspondent in New York, Michelle Fleury.
What we're seeing is by 2020, loss of 0.8% of global GDP. This is an equivalent of $700 billion. And what is most significant is that it is not the direct impacts of tariffs that are most harmful. Most harmful is the loss of confidence. What is so clear is that everybody loses.
Expecting trade talks to resume, what advice do you have to offer to these huge two trading partners?
I personally see criticality of recognizing that different countries have different grievances around trade and that we have to take to talk candidly about these grievances and then see how we can address them. If we fail to do so, then we are worse off. And that is not a good excuse if you can say, you know what, I'm a loser, but you're a bigger loser than me. I don't think that this is what people expect from leadership.
The director of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva. More than a billion people are living with visual impairments because they don't get the care they need for very treatable conditions. A report by the World Health Organization says an increasing number of people are experiencing eye problems and losing their sight globally, particularly in low and middle income countries. The BBC's global health correspondent, Tulip Mazunda, reports.
An ageing population, an increasing number of people living with diabetes, spending too much time indoors looking at screens, and a lack of access to decent eye care. These are some of the key reasons behind the rise in people suffering with sight problems around the world. Over 2 billion people have vision impairments or are blind, but around half of those cases could have been prevented or haven't been addressed yet. Dr. Stuart Keel from the World Health Organization said it's poorer countries that are worst affected.
One of the alarming findings is that the rates of vision impairment in some low and middle income regions are four times higher than they are in high income regions. So it is really about increasing access to affordable eye care. The leading causes of vision impairment could be corrected basically instantaneously with the appropriate pair of glasses, or a person's vision can be restored with cataract surgery overnight.
The UN agency says governments need to better integrate eye care into their national health services and make affordable treatments available to everyone.
Tulip Mazunda. Now, salts found in a crater on Mars suggest that dramatic climate fluctuations may have caused the planet's water to evaporate. Terry Egan reports.
NASA's Curiosity rover has been exploring the Gale crater since 2012. Now it's detected salt-bearing sediments that suggest a lake within the crater evaporated in stages around 3.5 billion years ago. While it's generally accepted that Mars was once wet and warm, with lakes and rivers and perhaps even an ocean, the red planet was slowly losing its atmosphere to space. That occurred around the same time as the lake evaporated, although how is not entirely clear. At some point, it lost its global magnetic field, something which had protected it from the solar wind. It became colder and drier, and as a consequence was less capable of supporting microbial life. These findings could tell us much more about how that happened.
That was Terry Egan.
Yeah, I thought it was a joke first, and then I realised, no, that's it. And this is getting real. It's amazing.
Coming up, we hear from one of the scientists who won this year's Nobel Prize for Physics. But first, there's increased speculation that Turkish forces are about to launch a major military operation against Syrian Kurds who it regards as terrorists. It follows President Trump's decision on Monday to pull back US troops from the border area, a move that led to widespread accusations of betrayal of the Syrian Kurds who played a crucial role in the military defeat of ISIS. In the city of Kashmiri on Syria's border with Turkey, Kurds injured in fighting against Islamic State militants protested outside a UN office to demand that they not be abandoned.
Because we sacrificed our lives and our blood for this land, we ask them to stand up to the Turkish threats and clarify their position, because it's not the first time Turkey's attacked. We do not want the case of Afrin to be repeated.
We do not want Erdogan to occupy our land. We want to protect our land and our people.
We came here to demand Turkey not to occupy. We have given our souls and bodies for this land. God willing, we are able to fight and stop the occupiers from taking over our land, even if it's the last thing we do.
Well, General Mazlum Abdi is the Kurdish commander of the Syrian Democratic Forces. In a rare interview, John Donison spoke to him via translator on the line to northern Syria. He asked him if he felt betrayed.
This decision hurt the credibility between us and the Americans and make it weaker than it was. And in case Turks invade the Kurdish areas in Syria, and the American army withdraw from this area, and the Kurdish people in Syria face genocide and ethnic cleanings, if this happened, I can call it betrayal. However, so far, we still communicate with Americans to try to find some solution for this decision.
Do you believe American forces will leave, all of them?
Domestic American decision, but if they withdraw without meeting those purposes or without achieving those goals, it's going to be a historical mistake for Syrian people and for other people as well.
You called it a possible Turkish invasion. If the Turks do launch a major operation in Kurdish areas over the border, how would you and your forces respond?
I believe we're going to have a long and wide fight between us and Turks. And this fight will not finish soon.
The Turks say you pose a security threat to them.
This is not correct because we are seizing the border with the Turks for 8 years and no one security incident happened along those 8 years. And something remarkable that 2013, 14, 15, our relationship with the Turkey was good. So I can say that we worked before with the Turks army. So this is undermining their story about we are posing security threat to them.
You are currently detaining thousands of ISIS fighters. What do you believe would happen to them if the Turks do launch this operation? Would you hand them over to them?
Of course, we will not hand over any of the prisoners to Turkey because Turks sent them to us. They're going to be under a risk situation in case of a military incursion in our areas. Because who is guarding them right now? They are most of them, they are Kurds, and those Kurds, their families, and their houses located in the border area. And of course, in any case of a military operation, on the border, those forces, the Kurds forces, are going to be forced to return to the border area and defending their families and their houses.
So is a Turkish military operation imminent? Well, the BBC's Ola Gurin is on the Turkish side of the Syria-Turkey border.
There's a sense of expectation here, and I think it's clearly being felt on both sides of the border. What we haven't seen, and we've been here for the past 2 days now, we haven't seen any evidence. We haven't seen any large-scale troop movements, any large-scale military build-up. That said, This border is already militarized. There are plenty of Turkish troops here. There are heavy weapons trained across the border on northeastern Syria. And the message that is coming from Turkish officials at the top is that we are ready, our preparations are done. And as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has put it, we could come any night. The president himself has been out of the country in Serbia. He's expected back in the next few hours. He may have something to say. But there has been no indication yet from the Turks of any kind of timetable. But they do seem determined to press ahead. And that is despite a growing chorus, if you like, of international condemnation and concern, worries about what this could mean for hundreds of thousands of Syrian civilians who are just across the border behind me and who have already suffered years of war. The European Union, for example, is warning that there could be mass displacement. The UN humanitarian officials have been saying they are preparing for the worst. And of course, there is acute global concern about what all of this could mean for the fight against Islamic State. What happens to the prisoners, thousands of prisoners being held by the Kurds? What happens to the newly liberated areas? Kurdish officials from the Syrian Democratic Forces have said to us, if the Turks come, we have to focus on that fight and we will have to withdraw many of our forces from those prisons and also from areas that were recently taken back from IS.
And this, in effect, would have to be an occupation, wouldn't it? I mean, how would the Syrian authorities view that?
Well, it's unclear that it would be an occupation. It's unclear that the Turks would go in and stay. So, for example, what you might have is a kind of limited operation. There is some speculation in recent days that it may not be as deep as the Turks originally said, that rather than one contiguous safe zone, as they have put it, and they were talking about this stretching for 300 miles along the border, that there might be a series of safe zones. So it's unclear to what extent the Turks plan to go in, spread across this territory and remain. But certainly we do know that their long-term ambition is to have what they would regard as a buffer zone here.
Ola Guerin. A leading al-Qaeda figure is said to have been killed in a joint US-Afghan military operation. The Afghanistan Intelligence Agency says Asim Umar and several other militants were killed in the attack on a Taliban compound in Helmand in late September. Our South Asia editor, Ambarasan Etarajan, began by telling us more about this al-Qaeda militant.
Asim Umar is believed to be the ringleader of the al-Qaeda group for South Asia. This was set up in 2014. And Asim Umar was made the leader around that time. And we don't know many details, but what we understand is he was actually from India and then moved to Pakistan in the 90s when there was a insurgency in Kashmir. There were many people who were crossing the border. And he was part of some of those militant groups. And then he lived in the tribal regions of Pakistan for a long time before moving to Afghanistan.
And what do we know about this raid that killed him?
There are very little details this Afghan intelligence agency they are giving about this raid. But what we know is in towards the end of September, there was a huge US and Afghan military operation in the Musa Qala district in Helmand province. And now the Afghan National Intelligence Agency says that the al-Qaeda leader was among those killed. There were six other militants killed in this raid, and it was a joint US and Afghan military operation. But we have to remember, there was a huge attack around that time. Dozens of civilians were killed in one of these operations. Probably this was the same one which happened around that time. There was a wedding party going on next to the compound of the Taliban. And then this Taliban compound was attacked.
And we've talked before on the World Service about the Taliban saying it was cutting ties with al-Qaeda. So why was this man in a Taliban bunker in the first place?
The Taliban militants have given refuge to al-Qaeda militants for a long time. You know, the al-Qaeda leader, Osama bin Laden, was inside Afghanistan for a long time until, 2001, when the US-led invasion, drove him out of that country. But there has been an understanding between al-Qaeda and the Taliban, because the al-Qaeda being a global group around that time, they were able to bring in expertise about explosives and various operations, and most importantly, money coming from the Gulf region, and they were able to channel it into Afghanistan. For the Taliban, it is giving them the technology and the money, and for the al-Qaeda, the sanctuary. Now, the Afghan officials would go around and say they will sever the ties with the Al-Qaeda. They will not allow the Al-Qaeda to use the Afghan soil. But here is the evidence that there are a number of militants who are embedded in Taliban units. This may come as an embarrassment for some of those who are negotiating. But that's why we haven't heard much from the NATO forces in Afghanistan about this particular raid.
That was Ambarasan Etarajan. A young black man from Florida who spent 10 days in jail after he overslept and missed jury duty has had his record cleared by the judge who sentenced him. The case of DeAndre Somerville gained widespread attention, with many seeing it as an example of how the US justice system criminalizes people of color. Farhana Darwood reports.
Judge John Castronakis sentenced 21-year-old DeAndre Somerville last month to 10 days in prison, a year of probation, 150 hours of community service, $223 in court costs, and ordered him to write a letter of apology to the court. The sentence for contempt of court was widely viewed as excessive, with the comedian Trevor Noah quipping, "You know racism is bad in America when a black man can get thrown in jail at someone else's trial." DeAndre Somerville served his prison sentence and began an appeal of his conviction. Now, after the backlash, the judge has decided to rescind the remainder of the punishment and wipe the young man's record clean.
Farhana Darwood. The 2019 Nobel Prize in Physics has gone to three scientists for their groundbreaking discoveries on the evolution of the universe. The Canadian-American James Peebles was recognised for his discoveries in physical cosmology. Two Swiss nationals, Michael Mayer and Didier Queloz, shared the other half of the award for discovering the first planet orbiting in another star system, a so-called exoplanet. Julian Marshall spoke to the new laureate, Didier Queloz, on a busy London rail station.
The announcement really caught me by surprise, because I was in a meeting with other colleagues and I got a phone call by the press office, and then they told me, and I thought it was a joke first, and I realised, no, that's it, and this is getting real. It's amazing.
And just remind us why you won the prize. What was it you did way back in 1995?
What happened 25 years ago is we detected the first planet orbiting another star. So that was the first time that someone demonstrated there is planet on another star, a star like the sun. And that planet was amazing, because it was a planet like Jupiter orbiting extremely close to the star. And the planet was, temperature of the planet was very hot. I mean, more than 1,000 degrees. We call this planet hot Jupiter. And that was a trigger for the field. It opened absolutely wide the idea that we can hunt for planets, and they are planets to be hunted. The planet may be different from the planet we have in the solar systems. And indeed, I mean, no, it's 25 years later, we have thousands of planets found, and they look very different. There's a world diversity. And it's all this started with the 51 peg story 25 years ago.
So you basically, all those years ago, you transformed our understanding of the solar system and our place within it.
Exactly. That's exactly a way to see that. I mean, we change perspective. The solar system was the only system with planet before 51 peg, and we had no comparison. We have no idea to understand how likely it is, or rare is the system, or common is the systems, and related quickly it is to get life, all this. So, I mean, in a way, we started this field. And that's really quite unique, because it's very rare at such a field, a new field start.
With all due respect, it's taken the Nobel Committee quite a long time to recognize your achievement, hasn't it?
Well, you know, I have no idea how exactly the Nobel Committee is working, but that's indeed, the discovery is 24 years old. Interestingly enough, for the first couple of years after discovery in 95, I mean, people were very skeptical. So I think it took some time for the community to digest that these planets are real. And I think it may have taken some time to realize that this field is a very strong and is growing field.
Have you discovered, Didier, any more exoplanets since then?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I don't count anymore. But I must have had hundreds of planets on my hunting list. We know there's plenty of planets everywhere. We're more focused on trying to understand better how they look like, really. I mean, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a planet like the Earth? Are we talking a planet like Neptune, or about Jupiter? And there's a lot of diversity that we need to explore. And eventually, we will be dealing with the atmospheric content.
And finally, in the Cold War, American and Soviet leaders were accompanied at all times by officers carrying the nuclear codes in case they needed to order a missile strike. The UK had a rather more eccentric approach, according to the historian Lord Hennessy, who uncovered the details of the plan in the National Archives. Oliver Conway reports.
In the early 1960s, fears of an all-out nuclear war seemed very real, held in check only by the threat of retaliation. So a credible deterrent was seen as vital. But if the Soviet Union had fired its missiles at the UK, the British response could have come down to whether a government chauffeur had enough money for a payphone. The British historian Peter Hennessy says the plan outlined in government files was so bizarre it would have been seen as a spoof by the KGB. If a nuclear attack was launched from East Germany, the then Prime Minister Harold Macmillan had to authorise a retaliation within 4 minutes. But what if he was out of London? Officials decided to fit his car with a radio link used by the AA Rescue Service to contact its mechanics. Once alerted, the Prime Minister needed to use a payphone to approve a strike. It was suggested government drivers were issued with 4 pennies to pay for the call. If the money had accidentally been spent, the plan was to ring up the operator and reverse the charges. The arrangement was approved just in time for the Cuban Missile Crisis and was in force until 1970. It was never needed.
That was Oliver Conway. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.